I would recommend getting the first one first before the second one, obviously, because the story won't make any sense if you don't play the first one. And it's just overall better game, in my opinion.
And you could probably pick that up pretty cheap, I guess, I would assume.
Yeah, like you can get... I mean, I got the Knights of the Old Republic, the first one, for about $15 a few years ago, so they're pretty cheap.
It's got to be like... they might pay
second
you to take them now.
$30 around that area.
Oh, okay. All right, man. Hey, well, thanks for joining us, Kirby. I look forward to hearing from you next month.
All right, thanks for having me on.
Play more role-playing games and then let me know about them.
I will. Try to do that.
All right, bye, man.
Adios.
All right, Keith, let's open the lines for our first special guest. San Juan Capistrano, go! Tommy Tallarico.
Yo, how you doing?
Good, I'm here. You are here. East-West Coast Connection. Tommy Tallarico, of course, most famous for the 200-plus, 200, over 250. What's the count now?
It's 275
games. 275
games,
of course, they are.
Do you want them in alphabetical order or chronological?
I would rather go chronological. I think that's what our listeners are expecting. No, but all that notwithstanding. Okay. Congratulations, you're in the Guinness Book, I guess.
Yeah, I'm in the Guinness Book of World Records. There's three records in the Guinness that I appear, but the one I'm probably the most proud of is the person who's worked on the most commercially released video games, and that's records. It's currently 272, but I've worked on three games since, so we'll have to adjust that for next year's Guinness. But also in there for the longest running video game television show, over 13 years with the Electric Playground.
Wow.
And then the third Guinness record is the most video game concerts in 1 year, which again it was currently 43, but we're currently in the midst of breaking that, and we do about 70 shows a year now with video games live. So it's pretty crazy.
I did not know that. Now, are any of those video game live shows available on like in a video format, or is just strictly audio? I own audio, but.
Right, yeah. We came out with an album last summer, Video Games Live Volume 1. It debuted on the Billboard charts at number 10, which is pretty cool.
That's amazing.
We're in the midst right now of working on a huge national television special. And then from there, the DVD will come out after that. Probably looking at the end of 2009, but more than likely maybe spring Q1 of 2010.
Because these Video Game Live, these are visual spectacles as well. I mean, you have the whole big orchestra there, you have DJs and everybody else. And
The reason we created Video Games Live was, you know, wanted to prove to the world how culturally significant and artistic video games have become. So, you know, want to create a show for everybody, not just hardcore gamers, but anyone, people who never played a video game or people who are casual gamers. And that's why we created the show the way we did. It's not just a symphony on stage playing video game music. Mm-hmm. But what makes it unique is that everything is completely synchronized with huge video screens and synchronized rock and roll lighting and special effects and a stage show production and interactive elements with the crowd and pre-show festival. And, you know, I kind of like to explain Video Games Live as having all the power and emotion of a symphony orchestra, but combined with the energy and excitement of a rock concert, mixed together with all the cutting-edge visuals, technology, interactivity, and fun that video games provide. So it really is a show. In fact, the people who are most surprised and blown away by the experience are the non-gamers. You know, I mean, gamers, we know how cool the music to Halo and Final Fantasy is, but,
sure.
You know, when you get somebody who hasn't played a game and they're hearing Metal Gear Solid and Kingdom Hearts for the first time, they're really amazed and they have a great amount of respect for the video game industry after that.
You truly are living a dream there, no doubt about that. You're a success story, but I don't want that to take away from the talent, the hard work that all went into it. I just want to step back a little bit. I mean, this is where you're at now, that and plus probably a whole lot more. You're going to take this global, I guess. But you growing up, let's go back. When did you first break into the business? I'm sure you've told this story countless times, but...
Yeah, no, it's a... My whole life, my two greatest loves and passions were always video games and music, but, you know, I never thought that I'd ever put the two together, because when I was growing up in the 70s, there was no such thing as a video game composer, so...
Yeah.
But, you know, my parents were a product of the 50s, so I started, you know, I pick up music by ear. I never had professional training or anything like that, so by the time I was, you know, 3-4 years old, I was playing the piano and banging out Great Balls of Fire and Jailhouse Rock for my mom and dad. And,
oh, yeah, yeah, I love it. That's what I grew up on as well.
I come from a musical family as well. I mean, my cousin is Steven Tyler from Aerosmith. His real name is Steven Tellerico. And so growing up, I was always into Aerosmith and Led Zeppelin and the Beatles and, you know, Pink Floyd and later on Van Halen and the Police. But it was in 1977 when Star Wars came out, and I was about 10 years old, where I really, for the first time, noticed an orchestra and a symphony. And because of that score, that kind of, and Rocky in 1976 was another big one, you know, that's when I started getting into classical music and the masters like Beethoven and Mozart. And that's when I kind of started to think, hey, instead of being a, you know, kind of a rock and roller, you know, maybe being a composer. And that's what really got me into it. But it wasn't really, and I was in bands and different things, you know, in high school and stuff. But when I turned 21 is when I moved out to California. I left my parents crying on the doorstep. I grew up on the East Coast in Springfield, Massachusetts. And, you know, I drove out to California with no job, no money, no place to stay, no friends, nothing. And, you know, the only thing I really knew was Disneyland. So I picked up a newspaper in Orange County when I got here the first day. And I saw a job for selling keyboards. I went down there that same day, and they said, you start tomorrow, you got the job. And I showed up for the first day. Now, I was actually homeless. I was sleeping under a pier at Huntington Beach.
Wow.
The first day I started at the music store, I was wearing a TurboGrafx-16 t-shirt, which back then in 1990, no one had video game t-shirts. Now you can freaking buy them in Walmart, you know.
Yeah, yeah.
But at Target, Kmart has them. But back then, it was a very rare thing. And the way I'd gotten that shirt is that the previous summer at the county fair, TurboGrafx had a tent set up, and you could play the games. And if you told them what you thought of them, you know, they took a little survey or whatever, they'd give you a t-shirt. And I waited in line like 2 hours that day. But so the first person who walked in the music store happened to be a producer at Virgin, and he saw my shirt, and he kind of, you know, said, hey, you want a job? You start tomorrow. So they hired me as a games tester first, you know, making $6 an hour to play video games. And I'm like, wow, I could die now. I could do this for the rest of my life. And so I was in California 3 days, and I was in the video game industry, and that was over 19 years ago. I would bug the vice president of the company every day. I said, look, whatever you need music, I'll do it. You know, you don't have to pay me. I just want an opportunity, because we didn't have like music people back then. The company was just starting. Mm-hmm. And so the first game that came up was a game called Prince of Persia, the original one. And did the music and sound with that, and won some awards, and so they made me the music guy, and that's the story.
And then that's how I ended up with you holding a keyboard over your shoulder with a strap, right? You know, in front of the Tommy Tallarico Studios. Then after you left Virgin, I guess.
I was at Virgin for about 4 years. I left in '94. A lot of people left Virgin in 1994 when Viacom bought the company, and it went from being a really fun, cool place to more of a corporate atmosphere. So we all kind of took off. You know, David Perry formed his company, Shiny Entertainment, and we started working on Earthworm Jim. And John Boddy formed Black Ops Entertainment. There was a bunch of offshoot companies. You know, the guys, a lot of people who worked there went off and started Blizzard. Started working at Blizzard and things like that. So yeah, it was a great time there in the early 90s to be working at Virgin, because it had such an amazing talent pool.
Now, I guess the sky's the limit now as far as what goes into, you know, orchestrating any type of music for video games. But back like when you said about Prince of Persia and older titles, the thing that I'm interested in is, you know, cartridges, sound, the FM synthesis, the PCM sound. How did that work? How did you compose the music and then it goes into a cartridge?
Yeah, I mean, back then, creating the music was the easy part. You know, getting it to sound like something was the difficult part. And, back then, when you didn't have much to work with technically, it was all about the melody, you know, and that's why some of the greatest video game music of our generation, was written, you know, the Mario, Zelda, Castlevania, Metroid, you know. Those are the games, because when Sonic the Hedgehog, when you only had 45 seconds and then it had to loop and you only had four voices to communicate with, it had to be about melody, about great melody, and that's why you got some of the greatest melodies back then. But that being said, when I started in the industry, there was no music and audio in general was an afterthought. You know, it was like, okay, the game's done. We don't have any time left. There's no budget. There's no space left in the cartridge. Put some sounds in this. We're submitting it tomorrow. And so, one of the first things I tried to achieve and change within the game industry in regards to audio is to make sure that people thought of it in the beginning and that it was something that was thought of that was important and, a major part of the gaming experience. And so, when you play some of the earlier games, that I worked on, like Disney's Aladdin and Cool Spot or Earthworm Jim and some of the Terminator and some of those, music and the audio played an important role in a lot of those games, along with the graphics and the gameplay and everything else. But it wasn't an afterthought. It was something that, we budgeted for from the beginning, both from a technology and space, cartridge space standpoint. And David Perry was really the guy, the lead programmer of a lot of those games I mentioned, that, was kind of the guy holding the torch, saying, hey, we need to spend more money on cartridges, to get bigger cartridges so that, Tommy has more space to do his stuff, So, it was a mind frame that had to change, a mindset. And then in the mid-90s, when CD-ROMs became available as a storage medium, that's when you started to see the industry change and people could start to record live music. But the reality was that the budgets hadn't caught up yet to the technology. So it really wasn't until the turn of the century that you started to see great scores like Halos and the Warcrafts and Metal Gear Solids and the God of Wars and the Final Fantasy and Kingdom Hearts and all the great ones. That's when all the big orchestral scores, Medal of Honor and those things, started to happen, because now, we could afford to record live orchestras and live choirs and live musicians and guitars and drums and all the rest. So yeah, it's been quite the trip. And to think about it, going back, only 20 years ago, we were all still doing blips and bloops, and it's come so far in such a short period of time. It's pretty amazing to think about.
So what did you what did you compose on back then, in the computer
I was one of the first guys, because I didn't know anything about programming, and back then you pretty much had to be a computer programmer in order to do music and audio for games, and I didn't really know any of that. I mean, I had done I'd messed around with the language BASIC, doing dirty text adventures.
Sure.
on my Apple IIe.
Yeah.
I think we all did that, the Commodore 64 days. But I didn't really know about programming, really. So what I did is I had programmers design me tools, specific tools, in which I could take my MIDI keyboard and plug it in. So not a typing keyboard, but a musical keyboard.
Sure.
And
sure.
Plug it directly to the sound chip in the box, in the hardware platform I was working in. And then I would attach that to a PC, which would I could control the sound of the chip, so I could mess around with it. But then I could also hook it up to another PC, and I would record it using a MIDI sequencer. So recording the different, you know, note on, note off, note value, note numbers, the note length, the velocity of the note, if there was any pitch bends and things like that. It was very, very simple. And so I was able to use a real keyboard in order to create music on those, you know, more archaic machines like the NES and the Game Boy and the Sega Genesis, Super Nintendo, and what have you. And that gave me a distinct advantage because I was coming at it from a musician standpoint as opposed from a computer programmer standpoint. You know, try to mouse click the blues. You just can't do it. You know, it's something that you just, you know, feel and you have to play. That was my kind of my trick back then, was getting a lot of space in the cartridge and also being able to play an instrument. Playing the machine as an instrument and recording that data was huge.
Speaking of the blues, and that's what I think is so amazing about. Of course, if you look down the, if you have 270 plus games, you're going to have probably, hopefully, you're gonna span genres, and that's something that you definitely do, and that's a good thing. But what amazes me is when things sort of like Banjo Race just come out of nowhere. How did that happen?
Earthworm Jim was a great, a fun game because we didn't really have a game design document for that one. It was about 10, 12 guys in a room for a year trying to make each other laugh. That was the game design document for that. So, you know, from the music, it's like, yeah, you know, we wanted to do some serious kind of, you know, techno-electronica type of stuff, but then we'll do a polka tune, and then we'll do a banjo tune, and then we'll do a, you know, let's play classical music on this level. Why? Because it's funny. I don't know. It's weird. And then we'll play Italian music the level after that, and then go back to a serious tune. So, you know, there was no rules. That was a fun one because, you know, I covered so many musical styles, kind of funny musical styles, from polkas to German music and Zydeco and banjo music and all the rest. That was a fun one.
Yeah, yeah.
Tommy, remember me. It's your old pal, Cakewalk 1.0 on DOS. What great times we had back in the day.
I'm just kidding. It's actually me, Titi Schmutkins. Isn't it nice to have a computer that can talk to who?
All right, that's the co-host, TT
Schmutkins. Oh, you scared me there. I thought I was being reunited with my very first MIDI sequencer.
Now, we came out a little bit different. I started on the Ensoniq EPS, and then the EPS-16 was the first sampler I got involved with, and sequencer. And we didn't have an Amiga back then. We had, I think, just a C64. And
yeah.
And my first trip into the studio, the producer there had an Atari ST. But you had the Cakewalk, huh?
Yeah, I was a PC guy.
I see.
And never got into the Mac side of things, because a lot of people do. A lot of musicians back then, especially in the late 80s, early 90s, Macs were kind of the only system you had. But I had a PC, and... And Cakewalk was really the only MIDI sequencer that ran on a PC at that point.
What's some of your favorite instruments now? What keyboards do you like to use now? Or
yeah, well, you know, it's all about plugins and things like that now. But again, going back then, I was a big Roland guy.
Okay.
So, you know, my first sampler was a Roland S50. And then, you know, you move up to the 770, which was the monster back then. It was a great machine. But, you know, I always liked the big fat analog sounds, like, you know, Oberheims, you know, the OB8s and things like that.
Yeah, I have a I have a JP8000.
JD8000.
It's one of the newer. They tried to go back to analog.
It's a beautiful that metallic dark blue machine. I got one. I'm looking at it right now in my studio.
Now
the JP8000 and they have the JD800. I have them both.
Wow, fantastic. Now, Now, you're a gamer, right? I mean, you like the video games.
Absolutely.
I hope so. What are some of your... Because else you're going to be miserable. What's some of your favorite things right now? What's going on now? What do you like?
I'm a big, when my friends come over and stuff, we'll play Guitar Hero and Rock Band. It's always still a favorite, you know. I'm on the road a lot, so I got the PSP and the DS, and, I like quirky stuff on the DS, so, you know, stuff like Elite Beat Agents, and I got this, it's kind of like Nintendogs, except it's for panda bears, so, you know, I take care of my little panda bear on the road.
I see.
On the PSP, I'm playing things like, God of War, Chains of Olympus, such a great game.
It is. And, it's amazing on there.
Any of the driving stuff, you know, Wipeouts and any of that stuff is great. But and then on the big machines, it's funny because, you know, I don't have a lot of time at home because I'm always on the road now. So I find myself like just trying to finish stuff that came out like a year ago. So, you know, I'm still playing like Metal Gear 4, trying to finish that. And Uncharted, actually, first one. I got about 90% through that one, so I went back and wanted to finish that. But even some of the older stuff, like on the PlayStation 2, like I've been playing Shadow of the Colossus lately, which I love because I never finished that one either.
Phenomenal.
And Beyond Good and Evil, another great one.
Yeah, I love Shadow of the Colossus. I love the Ico. I'm very excited about the new title that they're bringing out for the PS3. I think that's going to be amazing. And you were at E3. Yeah.
Absolutely, and that was actually one of my favorite games that they were showing there. It was called, what the hell was it called?
Yeah.
They were calling it Trico at first because it was like the third Eco or whatever, but it was called The Last
Guardian. Guardian, I think.
Last Guardian, that's it, yeah. I'm looking forward to that. But no, E3, I saw God of War 3 looked amazing. Uncharted 2 looked incredible. Really excited actually about the new Mario. It's called the new Super Mario Brothers.
Yeah,
because it's back the old school, you know, kind of side scrolling platform, which is awesome. And I don't know why companies gave that up. You know, I mean, it completely ruined the Sonic franchise when they took it to 3D.
True.
So those are some of the ones I was really, really quite impressed by. Of course, I'm a big Van Halen fan, so Guitar Hero Van Halen was there. The Beatles Rock Band looked awesome. So,
did you get to see George and Ringo there?
I didn't because I was preparing. We had a big show ourselves, a Video Games Live played at the Greek Theater during E3 as a part of E3. So
I see.
That particular night when those guys were there, I was rehearsing.
Yeah, you can check it out on your Xbox 360. You didn't miss much, unfortunately. We don't really know what this is, but thanks for having us on here, and royalty check and the end.
Oh, really? They didn't play the game or anything?
No, unless there's parts that were missing. They didn't even really understand what it was. Thanks for having us on your game show, they said. It's a great game show we're on. I have a feeling Aerosmith might be a little bit more in tune with what's going on with their version of the game.
Yeah, they're pretty hip, and they love the big royalty checks as well.
Sure, and who doesn't, I guess? Well,
thanks to the video game industry.
That's pretty amazing. That's pretty amazing. And what a big boom it has been for that franchise as well. Now, obviously, you get to realize a lot of your music-based ideas come to reality. But if you could make anything music-related happen, I mean, I know you're flying to Japan tomorrow. I mean, that's amazing. But if you could make anything happen, like Sky's the Limit, what do you think musically you would do?
You know, it's funny. It's an interesting question because, really, I mean, my whole goal in life is always to, you know, have a dream and achieve that goal and achieve that dream, and nothing will get in my way, and always have a positive mental attitude and all that stuff. And so, you know, the dream right now, I mean, I'm living it. It's taking the greatest video game music of all time and touring it all over the world in front of hundreds of thousands of people, screaming fans and audiences who just love video games and people who don't know anything about video games and getting them involved. And I mean, that I can't think of a bigger and better dream right now. That was my dream, has been for, you know, for the last 8-9 years, and because we started Video Games Live in 2002, and it took us 3 years to do our first show in 2005, and we did 3 shows in 2005, 11 shows in 2006, 29 shows in 2007, last year 47 shows all over the world. Wow. And this year over 70 shows. So you know, this is it. You know, this is the dream. I mean, what an amazing privilege and honor I have to take the greatest video game music. And we're always changing the show. You know, we do a 2.5-hour performance, and that constitutes about 20 games, or sorry, 20 different segments. But we've created over 60 segments for Video Games Live. So we've never played the same show twice.
Wow.
In the 4 years we've been touring this around, and we never will. So there's always something new for everybody, and that's why we come back to places like LA for 4 years, or, you know, the fourth year, Houston, Brazil, some of the places we go every year. You know, those people who've seen the show the last 4 years are going to see a new one this year. So yeah, it's building the audience and helping to spread the word.
That truly is living a dream. And, you know, it's not just a musician's dream. I talk to successful pro wrestlers. They want to be rock stars. I talked to Dr. Alan Hale of Comet Hale Bop fame. He didn't want to be an astronomer. He wanted to be a rock star. And then you throw the video game element into this. Who wouldn't want to be successful in the music industry or in a video game industry? And your story in particular can turn jealousy into inspiration. I know it certainly has for me. The more I found out about it, the happier I was for you and your success and the repercussions of that success. I mean, Video Games Live is beneficial to the entire video game industry. So let's get back to what brought you to the dance. Is there any more video game music coming out of the Tommy Tallarico studios?
You know, I got asked at the end of last year. Sega Japan called me up and asked if I wanted to do some music for the new Sonic the Hedgehog game. So that was a great honor.
Wow.
And so I was able to write 3 songs over the Christmas break last year for the new Sonic game that just came out, Sonic and the Black Knight, and for the Wii. And yeah, so, you know, still have my toe in the water, you know, doing music and sound design projects here and there, working on the new Lineage 2, doing a game called Flip's Twisted World for the Wii, and, you know, in my spare time, kind of in between tour dates and things like that.
Amazing. Well, thanks for joining us this month on We Talk Games, Tommy Tallarico.
Thank you so much.
Wow, Tommy Tallarico, what a guy. It's amazing. It's still working on games. Of course, the last game I worked on was Legends of WrestleMania. I was the motion capture model for Dusty Rhodes' Splotch. You can find out everything, of course, about Tommy Tallarico at tallarico.com or videogameslive.com. You can find links around there. And oh, everything's involved. Gang. He's had his hands in so much. The Tallarico Studios, of course. Amazing, amazing stuff. Keith, let's do 2 more What You've Been Playing. We got a new fella on the line here. And then, of course, I'll talk about what I've been playing, and especially on portable devices. Like, open them up! Madison, Wisconsin, go!
Hey, Wiggly, thanks for having me on the show.
On the line, Eric Alexander. Now, I'm going to call you, I'm going to do a little bit of that. I'm going to call you Eric Alex.
The man with 2 first names.
It's really your name.